Hey, Pioneers. Welcome to episode number 426. Today, we are diving back into our Homesteading 101 series, and we are getting to the basics of livestock. So in this episode, I'm going to give a brief overview on the amount of land you have onto what you could expect livestock-wise to be able to raise on that. And then we're going to deep dive into beef cattle. So I am very excited for this episode of all of the different livestock that we raise here on our homestead. Beef cattle is the one that I have the most experience in. I grew up on a cattle farm. My dad always raised beef cattle. And when I was little, he had the maximum size that his herd got to was about 130 head of cattle. And so that's funny because to some people, 130 head of cattle sounds like a lot, but to really big ranches and farms, that is really teeny tiny and small. So grew up going with my dad, fixing fence, building fence, feeding the cows, helping to pull calves when that happened, or being present for it when I was really little. It wasn't much help when I was really tiny, and all that it entails with keeping cattle. And then when my husband and I got married and moved out on our own, we started raising our own beef cattle. I was trying to actually remember the year, but we started, I think it was our third year of being married, and we're about to celebrate 25 years of marriage. So on my own as an adult, or with my husband, not technically on my own, but aside from my growing up years, been raising beef cattle for, what's the math there, 22 years. So I've got quite a few years of experience there with beef cattle, and I find there's a lot of information out there that I see on raising chickens and even raising pigs, probably less on raising beef cattle. So I thought that would be a really great place for us to start. And I really want to get into nitty gritty. So we'll see if this ends up being a part two episode. I'm going to try to get as much as I can into this and make this a singular episode. But oftentimes, of course, we can watch people, especially on YouTube, which I love YouTube. Obviously, the podcast is in video format there right now if you're watching it there. And I do YouTube videos and I enjoy watching YouTube videos. But sometimes when we watch things on video, it seems easy. And so I want to make sure that I'm really getting into the nuances of raising cattle and what that looks like time-wise, just to give you a very full understanding of that. So here we go. So first off, we need to know our land. How much land are you working with, and how much of your own of livestock can you expect to raise on that? So I need to preface that some of this does depend on your climate, especially if you are planning on having ruminant animals. So like cattle or sheep, right, that eat grass and can thrive on that. Versus chickens that are going to be eating different vegetables and grains, also bugs or meats, you know, that type of thing. So if we are talking ruminant animals and your goal and plan is to have those be fully grass-fed animals, your climate may require more acreage or less acreage. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. So a good rule of thumb, though, is if you have climate-dependent, of course, because if you are in a very drought, southern climate, this would require more acreage if you were planning on doing fully grass-fed and pasture-raised. But with that preface, about 4 to 5 acres, you can actually raise quite a bit of food, both produce, vegetable, fruit, as well as protein in form of livestock. So it actually takes less acreage if you're looking at doing it for just an individual family, which is in my definition, that is what homesteading is just to provide food for yourself and your family. And possibly if there's any excess, maybe to sell to neighbors or just a small amount of people in your community. But it is not like a farm, which is when I look at a farm or a ranch, that is really to feed a larger customer base than just a family and maybe one or two extra people. So if you are using regenerative farming practices like pasture rotation, you can get even more food from the same amount of acreage. So there is ways to maximize your said acreage as well. So if you haven't listened to the podcast episode that I did with Joel Salatin, which is on maximizing your homestead for profit and production, we'll put that in the show notes, or you can go to the blog post that accompanies this episode at melissaknorris.com /426 because this is episode number 426. Okay, so let's just do a quick rundown on the space that the different types of typical livestock are going to, or the most common livestock might be a better way to phrase that, are going to need. So chickens and rabbits are probably our smallest form of livestock, but we're raising for protein. So a lot of people can start there because one, the animals are smaller. So usually less infrastructure, easier to handle when you're brand new, all of those things, and less space, acreage required in order to raise them. So when it comes to chickens, you have your egg layers, of course, and those don't take up very much space at all. General recommendations, and I have to say our general recommendations, honestly, for most of this is from commercial bird production and raising them. We don't have a lot on the backyard. So I say these numbers as minimum. And you'll probably hear me say that a lot as we go into the different types of livestock, especially talking about beef cattle. I always think that more is better, not in the amount of animals, but more space is better than just meeting the minimum requirements. I've seen when you meet just the minimum requirements, yes, that is the minimum requirement that animal is going to take to be able to live without having a lot of issues. However, if there's additional space available, you mitigate still even more problems. And it's, in my experience, has always been better, especially long-term, rather than just keeping to that minimum space requirement. But if it's for something like meat birds that you're doing, typically you're going to be butchering them at 10 weeks, that is where you can get by with just the basic minimum requirements. And in my experience, it's when you are raising them over a long period of time, lots of months, usually years when it comes to laying hens and other, almost any other form with the exception of rabbits, pigs, cattle, etc. Even if you are raising them for meat, you've got a longer grow out period. So with our chickens, for egg laying hens, in the coop, it's about 4 square feet, 3 to 4 square feet is the minimum average inside whatever their coop area is. Now, run out area, exercise pen, whatever you want to call that, if they're not able to go out during the day and free range, then it's about 8 square feet. And so that, however, you can, on average, depending upon the breed that you get, you're going to get about an egg a day during the egg laying time, which for us is usually about March through October. And then your chickens will molt. And we don't force ours to lay. A chicken has so many eggs that it's going to lay throughout its lifetime. I like to give them the break that God and nature intended during the winter. I don't force them to lay with heat lamps. And so I actually have one of my hens is 6 years old and she is still laying in the spring for me. Now, I'm not getting a full egg a day from her. And she usually only lays through March through about July. And then she starts to taper off and I get even less from her. However, on average, during egg laying in their prime, averaging about an egg a day or every 24 hours. So depending upon the size of your family, how many eggs you go through, usually for a family of four, you know, really about, depending on how many eggs your family is eating and all of that, really about 5 eggs a day on average is going to be adequate. And so that is not a huge amount of space. That can be done in just a backyard setting very easily. Now your meat birds, again, if you're getting like the Cornish cross, which is what we raise, and we're butchering them at about 10 weeks, you know, when you're getting them as little tiny babies, obviously they need less space. They grow pretty rapidly. So by grow out time, though, really, if you've got about 4 square feet per bird, and we move ours in a chicken tractor, so they're getting moved to fresh grass every day. And we just raise the chickens, the meat birds, only in our yard, in a small section of our yard, probably about our whole area that our house on of our property is an acre. So I'm dividing this quickly in my head, probably between an eighth to a quarter acre. And then we just move them every day so that they're on fresh grass and fresh land. So there you go for your chickens. Rabbits, again, those are in hutches and can be raised in a very small amount of square footage space. I don't personally raise rabbits. So I do have some podcast episodes and some different things that we've done with people who do raise meat rabbits. So we'll make sure to link to that in the podcast description as well as the blog post. So if you're interested in raising rabbits, you can go and check those out. We dive much more into, obviously, space requirements, age, breeds, all the things if you're raising those for meat. Now, pigs, of course, as we go up right in size, pigs are going to take more space. Now, this is where you need to determine the standards and the way that you want to raise your animals. For me, I want that animal to be raised as close to as what it would be if we look back in history, like when they were wild or in nature before we were domesticating them and in the system that we have now. And I try to replicate that as much as possible. It's why we do grass-fed, grass-finished beef. We actually practice now mob rotation, which is more similar to how animals would have ate when they were in the wild, especially with cattle, that type of thing. Same thing with our pigs. I want the pigs to be able to root and to be a pig. They would have never stayed in this little tiny pen their entire life in nature. And when we try to do that, that's where we get a lot of diseases, a lot of issues, a lot of bad behavior from the animals because they are being forced to be raised into an environment that is completely not natural to them at all. So I preface that with pigs because technically you can raise a pig in 8 square feet per pig. However, I would never do that. Having a pig raised in just 8 square feet for its entire life is a very small amount of space. They are defecating where they're eating, even if they're doing it in a feeder. If it's on ground, it's going to be rooted to high heaven. I mean, 8 square feet for a full-size pig as it gets close to its butcher age. Can it be done? Yes. Should it be done? Not on my farm. So each of us have to make that decision though. How are we choosing to raise it? So for me personally, if I didn't have enough space, all I had was 8 square feet, I would not raise a pig. Pigs are also social animals. Most of your livestock is, especially when we talk about cattle, when we talk about pigs, even with chickens, they have safety within their numbers and with their herd. And so I would never raise a cow singularly all by itself. It should always at least be with another pair. And we'll talk about that as we dive into the cattle here in just a minute. But you need to think about that. So if you don't have enough space for the pig, I personally wouldn't raise a pig by itself and in just 8 square feet per pig anyways. Instead, I would rather seek out a farmer that is raising it as a pasture-raised pig, is feeding it the food that I feel is best. So if maybe that's certified organic for you, or it's using organic practices. We're not certified organic, and we do raise pigs about every other year. And we raise usually about 3 to 5 pigs, and then we do sell the excess as a whole or half pig to people. And so I'm not certified organic because that makes no financial sense for me to become certified organic when I'm raising it predominantly for ourselves, or I'm just selling a few every couple years. That doesn't make financial time sense for that type of certification. Is just silly for this small of an operation. So we use actually what I would say is better than organic, or is beyond organic practices, if you will, with our feed choices, with our management practices, et cetera. So a lot of times you can find small farmers that are doing that. You can ask them questions. A lot of times you can stop by, you can see how the animals are being raised, et cetera. And even though you might not on your land, you could purchase that from someone else who is raising it to those standards. So if you are super tight, like I said, 8 square feet only to raise a pig, I personally wouldn't do that. I would seek out another farmer and I would focus on what I could raise in the space that I have healthily. Okay, so we've kind of covered that. Now let's dive into how much acreage do you really need to have for cattle, beef cattle specifically in this episode. Some of this can go over a little bit to dairy cows, but overall, we're really focusing on our beef cattle. So with your acreage, again, this really does depend. And what I'm going to be sharing with you is if you're planning on doing it as a grass-fed, pasture-raised beef, because that is what I know. That's the only way that we've ever raised. Even on my dad's ranch, it's all been grass-fed, pasture-raised cattle. So where I live, technically, if it is prime pasture, meaning you have really fertile soil, really good growing conditions. You're not having drought experiences in the summer, right? Really extreme weather, which you cannot control the weather, obviously. But all of those things, you know, kind of go like into this perfect place. You could get away with raising a cow on 1 acre where I live here in the Pacific Northwest. However, Very rarely do we have all of those conditions all of the time. So best practice here is 2 acres. So I would say for where I live, about 2 acres per animal to not have to supplement feed and bring in hay and other outside sources during our main grass growing season, which for us is usually about mid-April, depending on the year, through October. Again, depending on the year, but through those months, in most times, I do not have to feed hay. Usually we can just, the cows are great on what our pasture and what is growing for those months out of the year. Now, of course, sometimes you have really drought, dry summers or different things like that. And we have had to feed hay actually in August. Last year, we had our spring started out really hot in April, which was really dry and really hot, unseasonably so. So by the time July and August rolled around, actually most of our pastures were dying. Like we thankfully had a lot of standing forage from buying the farm stay. So we had additional acreage to what we'd had in previous years, and we were practicing pasture rotation. And so we had sections of pasture that we didn't really have to feed a lot of hay in August. However, a lot of our local farms and local people around us did have to supplement with hay in August. So always just be cognizant of those weird weather years. It's something that you're going to have to deal with. And so like I said, I want to try to make this episode and giving you like as real can get with things to be aware of. So for us, we just figure 2 acres per cow for adult, average age size cattle. Of course, little small calves, they aren't going to require as much. They're going to be nursing off mom. Nursing moms do require some more feed, but it all kind of balances out. So you will need to know for your area what your growing climate is like, what your pasture is like, where you plan on keeping them, first and last frost dates, because here for grass, if you're not above 50 degrees Fahrenheit, at least during the day, if not a little bit more, the grass is really not going to grow. We don't necessarily have to be freezing at night, but if those daytime averages aren't getting above 50 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit, the grass is just simply not going to grow. So we kind of know once you hit November, even if we don't have snow and are freezing, we're not going to get any growth off of our pasture. So I would go and talk to local people in your area that are already raising cattle, ask them these types of questions, do some research in your specific geographical location to get some of these numbers. So when it comes to raising your beef cattle, knowing, okay, do I have enough acreage in order to raise them? And 2, again, cattle are a herd animal and should always be raised at least in a pair. I have seen where people have had just 1 cow. And again, can it be done? Yes. Is it best for the animal and best practices? No. So there's multiple factors that go into this. 1 is cows have their safety within their herd. They have a herd hierarchy, they're social, but they really find their safety within their herd. So when you have a cow completely by itself, it's never going to feel completely safe. That animal is likely going to be nervous. It can begin to exhibit just, you know, different social habits where it may be closer bonded with any humans. Now, you may think that that's a good thing. That's not always a good thing, in all honesty. You can get a cow that is pestering, sometimes could be a little bit aggressive just because it doesn't want to be by itself. So having a large bovine as a pet or exhibiting that type of behavior can have pros and cons, which is why if you ever get a small calf that you have to bottle feed for multiple different reasons, you actually need to be very careful that when it's little tiny, that you don't set up bad habits, that when that is a more than a 1,000 pound animal, when it's fully grown, it's real cute when you have a little baby calf that comes running up to you and wants to headbutt you because that's how they signal to their moms, right, to let the milk down in the udder. It ain't so cute when that's a 1,000 pound animal that's doing it, or that it wants to lean on you because when it was a little baby, that was sweet. There can be a lot of habits like that that we don't want to establish. So just kind of putting that out there. The second thing is when you have an animal that's nervous and doesn't feel safe, then it always has extra cortisol, extra adrenaline, right? It can't feel safe like it would when it is in a herd, or at least has another with it and you have a pair. And so that's going to affect the way that it puts on weight, the way that it manages its feed. Have a really high strung animal, that can affect, you know, when you sometimes flavor of meat, a lot of that is it butcher time? So, which is probably another podcast episode, in all honesty. I don't know how much we can fit into our time together here, but also flightiness. And so if you have an animal that's always nervous, it's going to be a lot more flighty. And if you have other cattle in your area, right? Cows can smell, cows can hear. And if it's all by itself, it's going to always want to be with another herd. So you potentially could have where a cow is getting out of fences a lot more, and you're having to repair fences, chase the cow to get it back in if it's not halter broke, etc. So while it can be done, I don't advise personally having a cow by itself. You always want to have them in a herd. And honestly, really too, from a financial perspective, we have always raised beef. Our herd is larger now, and I've got some different episodes that we'll link to. You can go back and hear kind of that evolution and where we're at now, size, etc. But even when we were just raising about 4 cattle, because we would keep the mom, then you would have the baby, and cattle aren't typically, you don't butcher cows. They're not at butcher size weight for beef until they're about 18 to 24 months of age. So you're going to have the mother, then you're going to have the baby calf. That calf will reach yearling stage. A cow gestation period is 9 months. So they typically have one calf per year. Cows can have twins. It's fairly rare, so it doesn't happen very often. We've never had twins. I think my dad may have had a set of twins once when he had, throughout my childhood that I can recall, with that large of a herd, just to kind of give you some perspective. So very rare for cows to have twins, so it is possible. So you're going to have a cow, you're going to have a yearling, and you're going to have a baby calf, and then that baby calf will become a yearling, and then that yearling will become 2 years old. So you usually have, in order to butcher one cow per year, if you are raising and breeding back to the mom and not just buying a weanling every year to raise up, you're going to have about 3 cows, right? Or 3 head of cattle, let me say, because it could be a heifer or steer, et cetera. A cow is a cow that is a female and has given birth. So a heifer is a female cow that has not been bred and given birth yet. There's little termination there, definitions. So if you want to be able to butcher multiple cows per year, have one for you, and then be able to sell the other one to help mitigate and offset cost, and really, in all honesty, as long as you have the acreage, it's really not, you're feeding every day anyways, you're checking fences, you're watering, you know, all of those things. It's really not any more work to raise, you know, 6 cows as it is 3, and then be able to offer your meat and then to be able to sell the excess. That's always how we've done it. And it's worked very well for us. And of course, now our herd's bigger. We're at 23 head at the moment. And then we'll be about 30 by the end of this year. And that's kind of where we'll maintain our herd size for the acreage that we have and the conditions that our pastures are in. So anyways, going back. So that's kind of what you need to know as far as your space and why it's advantageous to raise cattle in not singularly by themselves. Now, as far as the requirements, right, for the care of our cows, and the setup is you're going to have fence. Now, cows can barbed wire or hot wire. Cows do really well in that. Typically, you're fencing larger amounts of acreage. So we don't use like hog panel type fencing or those types of panels of fencing because we're fencing like acreage. We have, I gotta do some math here, 55 acres. And so the cost, if you were using the metal, like square grid cattle panels or hog panels to fence that, would just be astronomical. And cows, if you've got a good barbed wire fence in using some metal stays, and so that's because a cow is like a mouse. If it can get its head through it, it'll figure out a way to get its body through it. And so we usually do a 4-strand barbed wire fence. And then in between your posts, because right, you've got 2 posts and where it's anchored, the barbed wire at these posts, it's pretty tight. However, when you get into the middle expanse between the posts, where you've got your wire, there you've got more, more leeway. So if you've ever, you know, pushed wire aside to cross through a fence, you always go through where it's the loosest. Well, cows will do the same thing. So what we've found, instead of having to put so many more posts in, because that's added expense for your posts, added time, added labor, et cetera, is to use what we call fence stays. So they're this long section of twisted wire. Kind of looks like a really large bobby pin, except it's twisted. And you put those in that center section. And what that does is it holds each strand of wire between where the wire fence stay is twisted, in between the twists. So that way, if the cow tries to put its head through for whatever reason, or reach to grass on the other side, or who knows? I mean, cows are very curious animals. If you didn't know, they will do things you would never thought just because they're curious little creatures or big creatures. But if that way, when they try to put their head through, the wire won't stretch because it's anchored in the middle. And so that helps eliminate, trust me though, if you have cows at some point, they are going to get out and they're going to get through fences. Like, just know it's going to happen at some point in time. Way less than pigs and way less than goats, putting that out there. I've not raised sheep, so I can't speak to sheep. Way less often than those two varieties, but you raise cows long enough, no matter how good your fence is, eventually they're going to get out at some point in time. So just prepare yourself. However, fence stays with barbed wire fence does help to mitigate them pushing their way through the fence, and they don't get out nearly as often. Again, hot wire can work really well. Cows are actually sensitive to hot wire. If they've never been around hot wire, you have to train them like any animal so that they see that wire, and they recognize what's going to happen when they get up to it, and it shocks them, etc. But they respond very well to hot wire. They respect hot wire. So that's also another really good way to go. We usually do the perimeter of our fields and then some of the larger field sections where we'll have them sectioned off. We do that with barbed wire. And then when we do our mob grazing or temporary pens or those types of things, then we use hot wire for those because you can move hot wire really easy. It's not a permanent fence source. And so we'll do that. Or if we're trying to keep the bulls separate, especially from females that are may or may not be coming into heat that we don't want him to breed, then we will put him in a field that also uses hot wire with barbed wire as just an extra, like, nobody, you got to stay separate. Because if you have any type of cow in heat and you have a bull, it's very hard to keep him from doing what he wants to do. We'll just leave that there. So, okay. So you do need to have fencing, right? Obviously, you have to have a way to keep them fenced in and where you want them to be. Shelter. Now, with beef cattle, they have to have shelter, but they don't have to have a barn. So with beef cattle, if they have got some type of roof or somewhere that they can go to get out of really, really heavy rain, especially if you have cold rain. So here where we live in the Pacific Northwest, like, rain throughout the summer, not a big deal. Or even in the spring and fall, really not a big deal. Where the rain can get troublesome is when it's cold rain, where you're like 34 degrees Fahrenheit and raining for days on end. That will penetrate down because it's cold into their coats, and then they have a hard time keeping warm. They're going to burn body fat in order to keep warm, which can, you know, if they burn too much body fat, one, you have to increase the amount of feed that you're feeding, so that's an extra expense. And then it's harder to keep weight on them when they're burning that much in order to keep warm. So snow is actually different. Snow ends up insulating them, and they can stay warmer in snow than they can in cold rain. So we have had different areas where we do have a barn area that they can go in now. It's just open and they can go in. What's funny is they very rarely actually go in the barn. It's free for them to go in and come out as they want. It's only on those really cold rainy days or where it's like a snow rain mix that they will go into the barn. It's pretty fascinating. But we just got that barn when we bought our farm stay. We've raised cattle for years. So is my father my whole life. That's the first time they've ever had a barn in order to go in. Because as you can imagine, it's going to be real hard to have a barn that's going to fit 130 head of cattle. So instead is we have areas on our property where there's really thick evergreen trees, meaning they don't ever lose their leaves, right? In the wintertime, which is typically when they need the most shelter, is in the winter, at least here. So they can go under those areas and it's going to be a lot less rain. They can stay drier. The other thing is an area if you get a lot of wind, right? Because wind robs body heat. Same thing. at somewhere that they can get out where it's really windy. So sometimes that's a shelter. Sometimes that's different areas on your land. We happen to have both on my dad's property and then here on our home place. And at the other farm, we've got some natural dips. And so we've got a section of pasture and then it drops down a lot. And so where it's really windy, the cows will actually naturally come against that bluff of the bottom, where the bottom field meets the top field and there's that drop off. They'll come right here because the wind tends to just blow their backs because it's a tall enough drop. So some type of windbreak is something that's going to need to be provided if you live in an area where you get winds like that, especially during where it's colder out. Not so much a worry, obviously, during the summer months. Then on the flip side of that, obviously, if it's really hot and sunny, and we do experience that even in our summers here, they do have to have shade, right? They need somewhere that they can go to get out of super hot weather. So that doesn't have to be a barn. It can be natural types of shelter on your property, but you do need to be able to identify that in the area that they are fenced in, that they have these different areas during these different types of weathers that they can go and get shelter based upon whatever's happening during the seasons. So making sure that that's in place. Of course, water. Every animal needs to have water. Keep in mind, cows are going to drink more than obviously a chicken. So making sure that you have got a water source. We like to use the automatic waterers so that we don't have to worry about checking. Of course, the more cattle you get, obviously the bigger circumference of tub or water holder that you need. And so as our herd has grown, we found if we didn't have the automatic waterer turned on to those tubs, that in the summer months when it's really hot out, that those tubs could need to be refilled two or three times a day. So we just have invested in automatic waterers and put those on the tubs so that it's always refilling as they come and drink. And then, of course, you still have to visually check because things can break, hoses can bust, automatic waterers can get shoved off by the cows, etc. So still, you know, keeping eye on the herd, but we love the automatic waterers. So I actually have backups. So if they do bust one off, I got another one, I can slide right in its place. But being cognizant of that. Now, you may have an area where you've got ponds, where you have sloughs, just making sure that that water is clean when in the summer, if you get really dry, that they don't dry up or get to the point where the water is like, you know, gross because there's not enough volume. Those types of things. You may be lucky enough, however, though, that you would have a natural water source. And so you could take advantage of that. So those are kind of your basic, right? Basic requirements when it comes to your beef cattle. Now, as far as planning for them to eat, so I have a post that breaks down for you. We will link to it in, again, the show notes, and it's titled Stocking Up on Animal Feed, but it goes into how much feed is needed per animal. So when we are talking about ruminants, and then my example is obviously done for beef cattle, they require 2.5% of their body weight in dry feed forage a day. So a 1,000-pound cow, for example, will need to consume about 25 pounds of dry weight forage a day. So both grass hay and regular grass, right, have moisture content to them. So when we're looking at this 2.5% of their body weight in dry weight forage, we have to calculate the moisture content and add that for the additional pound to get final feeding numbers. So if you have a 1,000-pound cow at 2.5%, that would be 25 pounds of dry weight forage. Grass hay, which is what a lot of people will feed, is approximately 8% moisture content. So you would take that 25 pounds of dry weight forage for your 1,000-pound cow, times it by 8%, 0.08, and that would equal out 2 pounds. So you add 2 to 25 pounds, and that would say you would need 27 pounds a day. Then always estimate that some of the hay will be wasted. Even if you're feeding it in feeders, always estimate that a little bit of the hay is going to get wasted. It's just the nature of the game. So for that, 8% grass hay moisture content, 1,000-pound animal, average about 30 pounds per day is what you would need to feed that animal. We predominantly feed haylage. It has a much higher moisture content and it averages at about 40% moisture content. So our daily amount based upon a 1,000-pound cow would be 25 pounds dry weight forage times 40%, 0.4, which would equal 10 pounds. So you can see where we would do the 25 pounds plus 10 pounds that we should be feeding approximately 35 pounds a day with an additional few pounds thrown in for waste. Now, so there you get a basic average, right? But honestly, within cows, obviously you're going to have different weights of different sizes, right? So do your math there. But you've also got just different genetics. And so some cows are what you'll be called both in the horse world and in cow world is, have you ever heard the term like they are an easy keeper? Or man, that is a hard keeper. So easy keeper means that even throughout the winter or whatever, like that animal just always keeps their weight, their conditioning always looks good, and they're just easy to keep healthy. Whereas a hard keeper, I had a horse like this once, a hard keeper is like you feed them all the things everybody else is getting that's the same age, size, etc. But that animal just skinny, like you're constantly pouring them extra, giving them extra feed, giving them extra supplements, whatever, and you just cannot keep weight on that animal. They are a hard keeper. So when you're looking at your herd, that is one of the things that we look for. And so if we ever have a cow that is a really hard keeper, or if we were to have a bull that all of a sudden the cows had been bred to a different bull and their calves were never hard keepers, but all of a sudden we started with a new bull and those calves became hard keepers, that would be genetics that you wouldn't keep. You'd stop using that bull, or you wouldn't use that cow anymore because you don't want to create genetics, right, for hard keeping animals, because it's harder on them. It's not financially feasible for you, like all the things. So I also want to talk about with beef cattle, talking about grass fed and grass finished beef and talking about the genetics. So when you are looking to buy your cows, you need to buy from somebody who is doing grass-fed already. Because if you try to take a cow that has been fed grain and has been supplemented a lot of things besides just being on pasture and pasture forage and grass hay, and they have been fed grain or they've been supplemented a lot of different grains and not just eating grass and or grass hay. And just so you know, an animal is still considered grass fed, even in the winter, if it's been fed hay, as long as that hay is grass hay, right? It's meaning that it's not been fed a lot of grain product. Sometimes people are like, well, they have to feed hay during the winter. It's not grass fed. No, that's not true. Just so you know. So back to my point on this, however, is that the genetics have been bred over time if they're feeding corn and other grains to that animal. And if you try to switch them just to grass, you're going to experience some weight problems and possibly some other health problems. So if your goal is to do totally grass-fed, we do it. We have a winter climate. It's all I've ever done. We have Black Angus. We have had Hereford. We've had Red Angus. We've had crosses where we've crossed our Hereford with the Black Angus, Hereford with the Red Angus. And we also have Scottish Highlands. All of those, my dad's herds, my brother's herds, our herds, all of those herds have been grass-fed only herds. And so ours flourish and do phenomenal in that with that feed. But if we were to go to auction and or a different farm that did not just do grass-fed and you tried to do that, you might be able to be fine during the summer months, and especially harder to do if you have dairy animals. But in this, we're talking more about beef cattle breeds with cows. But you need to be cognizant of that because it is you're going to most likely have problems trying to transition them because it's went back in the breeding to what they're being used to. And that's the way that that's developed. So if your goal is to do grass-fed, grass-pastured throughout the whole with your beef cattle, start with a herd that has that. Start with lineage that's already been raised by that. And you are going to have much better success in doing that. Okay. Now, what about over winter months when things are usually not growing? Again, this depends upon your climate. If you live in a warmer climate like Georgia, I know when I was talking with Will and Jenny Harris from White Oak Pastures, I've been down to their farm a couple of times in wintertime, and they really only have to feed hay November through, I think they said February, so much shorter. And they still have some grass that's growing in forage, but they do feed. And then it's grass all the rest of the time. And they're not getting a ton of snow. So even when they're feeding hay during those winter months, they're not having to feed that much extra. Whereas in my climate, as I shared, we're really October through April. And then when it's really cold or that really wet cold, depending on, you know, where it is, but if you're, you know, down into single digits or negative, I don't get negative where I am, but we did get 5 degrees Fahrenheit is the coldest on record here in my lifetime where we live. And that was an overnight low. But where I'm sharing this is because you do, most places have to feed or at least do some type of supplement feeding in winter. And if the weather is very severe, then you are going to have to feed more because that animal is using more of its reserves and it's using more energy, it's using more calories in order to keep warm and try to maintain its baseline and its body conditioning. So therefore, if you don't feed extra, it's going to burn through its fat. And you know, it's kind of normal for some animals to lose a little bit of weight in winter, but you have to keep an eye on their body conditioning because you don't want them to drop too low. And so just be cognizant, you're going to usually have to feed during inclemental weather and harsh conditions. In winter months, if you live in a cold climate, northern climate, you're going to have to feed more. So you want to calculate in when you're buying feed for that. Now, some things that we've been practicing and working with our pastures to try to help mitigate how much hay we have to buy is having standing forage. So with using the rotational mob grazing, we've got some sections that we try to let grow up at the end of our growing season. So for the end of August, September, really, letting that grow up and get taller and longer. And then when we hit where the grass really stops growing, then we can move the cows into those fields and they can still browse on that grass, even though it's not growing anymore. And we don't have to feed as much hay because they can supplement with some of that forage. And I've got a really cool episode recorded. I can't wait to share with you guys where we're going to be talking about different types of fodder for all different types of livestock, as well as tree foraging and tree fodder. So I don't want to give it in this episode. Just know it's coming and that can help. I'm super excited. It's a really awesome episode and I'm going to be implementing some of the things from it this year into our herd. So anyways, that's like a little teaser for upcoming episode. Okay. Now back to talking a little bit about genetics with your cows and starting your herd. Again, like looking at breeds and researching breeds for your geographical location and what your goal is. We're talking beef cattle here, so beef. Now, I'm going to say this from my years of experience and also talking with Will Harris, it was kind of funny. The breed can determine the size of the animal and can determine, right? So the larger animal, the larger stakes you're going to have. Okay. I mean, that kind of like makes sense, right? Obviously the bigger the animal is, the bigger steak cut you're going to have, the bigger the roast cut, et cetera. However, the flavor of the meat in my experience and my opinion is how that animal is raised and fed. I don't think that breed affects the flavor. It affects the size. And sometimes the breed can affect the way that it marbles. We'll talk about that in a little bit, which can affect the flavor. So I guess a little bit there. But as far as like saying, oh, taste this steak, that's an Angus steak. Taste this steak, that's a Hereford steak. I've only seen in the way they've been fed that, and if they've been aged versus not aged, like butchering practices, etc., that much more determines flavor than breed, in my opinion. So it was funny. I was having this conversation with Will Harris because they raise thousands of cows. And so you have a much bigger pool to go from. And then they butcher on site. They have their own butchering facility. You can check out that episode as well that I did with him and Jenny. Fascinating episode on what they're doing with regenerative agriculture and on their farm, White Oak Pastures. However, we were having this conversation when we were going through and I was asking him about what breeds they ran and all this different stuff in their breeding program. And it was really fun because I'm like, that's what I've been saying. So we kind of had that bonding moment, if you will. But you do want to look at how that breed is in your location. So for example, we have started, we're going on our second year with the Scottish Highlands. I live in a northern environment, right? And so the Scottish Highlands makes sense for us as a breed for a couple of reasons. And I'll share that, why we chose to integrate those into our herd. And we're starting that with our beef production. But it would not make sense in a southern environment at all to try to raise Scottish Highland. Again, like a really short-haired, thin coat breed would not make sense in a northern environment for me to try to raise. So be cognizant of that. Now, the reason that we picked the Scottish Highland, for a couple of reasons, like look at their native too, like where did they natively come from, right? If it's from a Mediterranean climate or a really warm climate, like down in, you know, like Southern America, et cetera, they would still do well in a southern climate. Not so hot in the north. So you do want to look at those things. But we picked the Scottish Highland because of, they have two coats. They've got like their normal inner coat, which would be much more like a Hereford or an Angus breed, etc. Then they have that long, shaggy outer coat, which is why they're so adorable. And even though I've had them for 2 years, I still look at them in the field. I'm like, oh, you're just so cute. So anyways, however, that outer coat, that shaggy outer coat, means that they don't need to store an outer fat layer like other breeds do. And what that means is that fat is then marbled more throughout the meat. So, and the more marbling that you have throughout the meat, right, that affects the flavor, it can affect the tenderness, etc. So naturally, they have that built in, which is going to give us, in theory, we've not butchered our own yet, but I've talked to a number of farmers who are in my area, or in a northern climate, I should say, that raise Scottish Highland. And that's been their experience. So that is one. They're more of a forager. So they naturally will forage, not as much as a goat, but way more than I've seen our Hereford or our Angus breeds do. So they will go and they will eat like lower the leaves off of brambles. They'll just go in areas and eat more and better utilize those calories than the Hereford and Angus. So that's great for us. Again, though, during the summer months when we're mob grazing, we actually can't mob graze them into certain areas of our pasture that don't have trees for shade, or as much shade, whereas our Hereford and Angus are fine in those pastures. So there's a little bit of a trade-off there, just keeping eye on their needs with that. But that breed does really well for us. We also knew we were doing the farm stay, and people look at them and they're like, oh my gosh, they're so cute, because they really are so cute. So I also knew from a marketing aspect that when people were looking to book our farm stay and they saw pictures of these beautiful little Scottish Highland cows and their little cute little calves that look like teddy bears with legs, that would be a natural draw for people to pick our farm stay over a different farm stay that might not have these adorable, cute cows. So I had multiple motives for bringing this breed into our herd and raising them out. Now, here's the other thing, however, when you're looking at beef cattle, as I said, it's about 18 to 24 months before they're going to get to butcher size. Pure Scottish Highland, it's 3 years. They're a slower growing cow. And so they eat less though. So it about sets off in cost-wise. But you need to know that it's that long-term investment. So you'll have your upfront investment of purchasing your cows, the feed for if you purchase them as calves, right? Or you get a cow that is bred. So you're going to have a calf on the ground. You're looking at about 2 years before you're going to get your meat and or any type of financial, you know, return if you're selling part of that meat. So that is something that you do want to consider. Again, buying, like picking it, like I would go to a farmer. I don't ever buy from an auction. You just never know what you're getting. And in most times, people aren't sending their best cows and their best herd lineage and genetics to an auction. There's a reason that they're going to an auction rather than selling outright. Now, I'm not saying you can't ever get anything good at an auction, because that would not be true. But in general, most circumstances, I don't know people who are sending their best stock to the auction because they're going to sell them outright. Or they're going to keep them for their own breeding genetics, because you get more if you're selling it directly too. Like we've got some local farms. Like my brother has a herd. So we've went to him and I've said, hey, we want to bring in some more cows. And so we bought some 3-year-olds that were like 4 months away from being due. He's like, yeah, I need to downsize. So we bought them from him. But again, I could go and look at his herd. I can look at his genetics. I can look at what they're raised on. I know what they've been fed on, all of those things. I can see if there's any suspicion of different disease, like all of those different things. You don't ever know when what you're getting through when something's coming through an auction, nor do you know what when they go through an auction. They, at least in my state, I can't speak to other states because I don't know, they do have to have a certain amount of vaccines in order, in most cases, to go through. We don't vaccinate our herd. We have a closed herd, closed breeding. So we've never vaccinated, never need to, never had any issues. And I have to say, in all of my dad's years of having cattle, all our years of having cattle, with our beef cattle, I've only ever had to have a vet out once. And that was, we had a mom that had rejected the baby. And then the baby didn't get enough colostrum, even though I'd given them colostrum from the store. But he actually, it was a hard birth. And during the birthing process, he had swallowed some of his poop. He was in the birth canal too long. And so he got E. coli. And so he had to have an antibiotic as to save his life, which I felt in that instance, like I said, we don't give antibiotics to our animals and we don't vaccinate them. But in that instance, I'm like, okay, I give him an antibiotic. This calf is 48 years old when the vet came out, 48 hours, 2 days old. There we go. And so to me, it made much more sense to give that calf that antibiotic, save his life. He was a steer. And then 2 years down the road, you know, that antibiotic had went, it's not like he was getting it daily or anytime after that. Only time that we've ever had to have a vet out for a beef cattle and or give them any type of medicine in that. Now, we've had other things where I've just self-doctored them at home, used herbs, and that has all worked out really, really well for us. So that's also something else. You do need to know that you may or may not have to call a vet. As I said, we have not. Except that one time, and that was a birthing instance. It was with a cow we got. It was her first birth. And as far as genetics go, she didn't want to take the calf. She had a hard time, all of those things. And so we did not keep any heifer calves from her. And we did not end up keeping her, actually, because if a cow is not a good mom, now their first one, sometimes they just don't know, they instinct hasn't quite kicked in, or they just don't know what they're doing. And if they will accept the calf, even if they don't at first, but if they get to where the calf is nerving, they accept it and they raise it up good, we'll give them a second chance. If they have two really hard births in a row and or they reject the second baby, that's not genetics I want in my herd. That's not a cow I'm keeping in my herd. And then we butcher them or sell them and tell the person, obviously, that, like, hey, here's what to expect. Here's what has been our experience with her. We've only had it happen once. But I told you I wanted to try to keep it real, right? So those are things to know with beef cattle. And again, so looking at local farms, as I said, and seeing, you know, when they're selling off, oftentimes, especially with beef cattle, like ideally you are butchering steers, because a steer, which has been castrated, right? It's obviously born a male and it's a bull, or it's born a girl, a female, and it's a heifer until it's had its first calf and it's a cow. And then when you castrate, that's a steer. So ideally, you're butchering steers, because steers at 2 years of age, you have a steer and you have a heifer at 2 years of age. Well, the steer is going to weigh more. The steer is going to be bigger. Testosterone is one of those things. So therefore, you're going to make more because you're selling it by the pound when you're selling it as beef, right? And so financial wise, it makes more sense to butcher all steers because you have more product to sell per animal. However, you don't get to determine, we don't AI, so I should say, you don't get to determine unless you're AI. We don't AI. If you're getting a female or a male calf, right? You get what you get. So a lot of times, if you've got farmers that are raising beef cattle, and if they get too many females, then they're going to sell some of those female calves off because that's not what they want to be butchering. So oftentimes you can get yearlings or wingling, like when they've just been weaned, female calves, and then you could start your herd with them. Now, however, if you're getting a calf, right, you're not paying as much, so it's not that upfront cost, but they really need to be about 18 months of age before you breed them. With your kind of your standard like Angus, Hereford breeds, et cetera. For Scottish Highlands, it's going to be older because they take longer to mature. You don't want to breed them too early because they're not going to be big enough and you'll have trouble at calving time, right? So you do want them to be at a certain size and developed, which is about 18 to 24 months, 18 months to 2 years of age before you breed them. And then there'll be another 9 months, right, as that baby's growing in the gestation period before they have that calf. So if you get a calf at, say, 6 months old, you're going to feed it and have it for about a year and a half before you can breed it. And then you've got that next 9 month gestation period before you're going to actually have a calf on the ground. So you get it cheaper up front. This is going to depend on, you know, how much pasture do you have? How much forage do you have? What are your hay resources? Do you have enough acreage to hay? Because that's ideal, right? Then you're not, you are having equipment to hay and time and labor, but you're not having to buy hay outright. We do not have enough pasture to hay, at least not where our pasture fertility is right now. And so we purchase hay, always have purchased hay local from local farmers, again, where I can go and I can see the fields. I know what the content of the hay is. I know them personally, so I can go and talk to them to find out how the fields have been treated, all those different things. That's important to me. You do want to know those things, especially if you're doing grass-fed, grass-finished. For me, because I don't want to be feeding them grass hay that has been sprayed with any type of pesticide or herbicide that I would not want my animals consuming, because I don't then want to consume through their meat. I mean, that's the reason I'm raising my own meat, right? So that I know what goes in it. So you will need to look at hay sources if that's not something that you can hay yourself and or you don't pasture and year-round growing. So ideally, get on farmers' wait list, like find out, start asking in your area, like who does hay and that. And then you want to talk to them early in the season, because oftentimes if you wait until the end of summer, they're sold out. And if you have summer where you maybe have drought and they can't get a second or third cutting, around here where we live, you can usually always get one, a first cutting. First cutting is not always as good. It's usually a little bit cheaper price, and that has to do with protein content. Like, there's lots of different things to go into that because of the nutritional macros and the hay, et cetera, on a first cutting versus a second cutting versus a third cutting. Some areas of the country probably can even get fourth cuttings. That's not been something that we've ever experienced. Normally, you can get a second cutting here. And so second cutting is a little bit higher priced. It's later in the season. However, the past couple of years, because we've had droughts here, there's not always been second cuttings, which means if you were waiting for the second cutting, there might not have been any, and whatever was left from first cutting that hadn't been sold, when it's apparent that a second cutting's not happening, that price goes up, which hay prices have went up considerably in the last 5 years around our area. And of course, there's always some inflation, but there's been a lot of other factors. Some of it's weather. You know, there's a lot of things that go into that. Their cost has went up, etc. But something to be aware of. So if you can get on those farmers' lists and say, hey, this is how many bales I'm going to need, you know, to take you through those off-growing months, always giving yourself a little bit extra in case of inclemental weather that you're not aware of, or if you have a really cold spring and the grass doesn't start growing as soon. We've had that happen to us as well, where we did have to feed into May, which was unusual, but you don't ever want to run short of hay. It's better to have extra, and then you can use it as bedding, you can use it in, you know, composting, you can use it as mulch, or you can hold it and just feed it if you need to throughout the summer months. Obviously, it loses some of its nutritional content the longer it goes, but we've never wasted ours. We've always been able to use whatever we had extra in different fashions. So always better to have a little bit extra than to run short and not have enough feed to feed your animals. It's never a situation that you want to go into. Okay, this is actually getting to be pretty long. I tried to fit as much as I could into it. And some of you did email me in and actually asked me specifics that were shared in this episode. So if you want a part two on beef cattle specifically, let me know either in the comments if you're watching this as a YouTube version of the podcast, or email me in if you're listening. I try to pretend I'm cool. If you're OG, old-time listener listening to this on a podcast app, etc., please do email me in. And if we need to do a part two, I am more than happy to do that. Just want to know what information that wasn't covered in this one that you're wanting to learn and to know. Today's podcast episode is sponsored by Azure Standard. And Azure Standard does sell sustainably raised meat products. So they have got some beef products. They've got some beef jerky. I confess, we do order some of the beef jerky for my son when he's working construction jobs. It's a great protein snack. And I don't always make our own jerky from our own meat. Sometimes I do, but when I don't, I do supplement from Azure Standard. They have got beef, they've got chicken, they've got lots of different options on meat as well. And it's always from a sustainably raised farm and brands. They also carry A2A2 organic milk products, specifically cream and different things like that, which of course, not beef cattle, but from dairy cows. So definitely check them out if you are looking for some sources and you don't have a local farm source where you can get some of those items from. You'll want to check that out from Azure Standard. And you can use coupon code Melissa10 to get 10% off your first order of $50 or more. So for first-time customers, $50 or more for your first order, use coupon code Melissa10 and you will get an additional 10% off of your order. Now, to wrap this episode up with our verse of the week, we are in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 4. And this is the Amplified translation. Who comforts, consoles, and encourages us in every trouble, calamity, and affliction, so that we may also be able to comfort, console, and encourage those who are in any kind of trouble or distress, with the comfort, consolation, and encouragement with which we ourselves are comforted, consoled, and encouraged by God. And it goes on a little bit more into that, definitely worth a read. But I wanted to share this verse with you because I have had the opportunity the past few weeks with different individuals who were dealing with possible miscarriages. And I share that because I don't know if you know this part of my story or not, so I'll try to keep this brief. But I had an ectopic pregnancy, which is a tubal pregnancy, and that was actually my first pregnancy, and ended up having to have surgery, and the baby I didn't have any of the early signs of an ectopic pregnancy, which is a lot of abdominal pain and oftentimes a lot of bleeding. Those are kind of your signs. And so they caught it by ultrasound and by lab work because my levels were not, they should be doubling. There's certain hormones that they check for, and those levels should be doubling with a healthy, viable pregnancy. And so it was actually the lab work that came back off. And they said, your labs are off. We think you should come in and have an ultrasound. Because at that point I was about eight. This was a long time ago, guys. This was like almost 20 years ago now. But I was at, I believe, what should have been about 9 weeks pregnant. And so I'd had the initial ultrasound that showed the heartbeat, like when I first went in. And then this was like a month later. And so went in and there was no heartbeat showing anymore. And from what it looked like on the ultrasound, they're like, we're pretty sure this is an ectopic tubal pregnancy. And so we're going to, at that point, a lot of doctor's offices didn't have like 3D ultrasounds. And so they said, we need you to go to the hospital where they have a higher ultrasound so that we can make sure, but we're pretty sure that you have a tubal pregnancy. And, that was a really hard, really hard time, period. And I did have a tubal pregnancy. And I say this, even though it might sound funny, but thankfully, the baby had stopped developing because if it had grown to the size it should have been at that time period, I would have had a lot more complications and possibly could have died. So unfortunately, I lost that fallopian tube and that pregnancy, which even 20 years later, like it's still hard. And I am so grateful that I have two beautiful, wonderful children. But there's still a part of me that knows and that feels the loss of my third child that I'll get to meet in heaven someday. But the reason I share that is because that was a turning point in my life where I turned back to God. And He walked me through that time very powerfully, and He used other women who had went through loss of pregnancy and loss of children to minister to me at a time I desperately needed it. And so I've had the opportunity these past few weeks to be able to do that for others. And so this is very real to me, because oftentimes when we're going through something that's hard, it can be easy to question, or it was easy for me to ask God why. Like, why is this happening? And you can get lost in that, right? But I firmly believe that bad things just happen. We live in a broken world. We live in a world with sin, and hard things and bad things happen in a broken world. However, if we turn them over to God and if we trust in Him, I firmly believe that He can take the hardest things that we go through and He can turn them into something that can have good come from it later down the road, sometimes in the moment. And so this verse, as I was reading it, felt very applicable to the things that I've went through in my past that I just shared with you. But being able to see that, because I've walked through that and God comforted me in those times and brought people into my life at that time, I'm able to do that for others that are now going through similar circumstances that I went through. So it felt like it very much brought that verse to life. And so I share that with you because maybe you're going through something that's really hard right now. And there'll be people that will be able to offer you comfort and to walk alongside you. And later you'll be able to do the same thing. Or maybe you're like me and you've went through something in the past that was very hard, but you'll be able to come alongside and comfort people as they go through their hard trials because you have went through those things and you know what they're going through and you know what helped you and you're able to offer that to them. So didn't mean to get so heavy with you and quite so emotional, but I hope that this offers hope and comfort to you if you're going through that, or allows you to give that to someone else through, of course, obviously, the grace of God. So on that note, thank you for joining me for today's episode. And I look forward to being back here with you. We've got some great episodes coming up. Blessings in mason jars for now, my friend.